Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Julie Ellenbecker, president of Ellenbecker Investment Group. EIG believes in the importance of education, allowing people to gain the knowledge to feel confident in their personal decisions. This show highlights the unique financial perspectives of its many guests, including economists, attorneys, book authors, business owners, and tax professionals. It is provided for general information purposes only and does not consider your particular investment objectives or financial situation and is not intended as recommendations appropriate for you. Before acting on information on this show, strongly consider seeking advice from your own financial advisor. The opinions expressed on Money Sense do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Ellenbecker Investment Group employees and leaders. Please enjoy today's show.
Money Sense is brought to you by Ellenbecker Investment Group, four-time recipient of the Better Business Bureau Torch Award for business ethics and integrity. Ellenbecker Investment Group is the only Wisconsin investment company to receive this prestigious award more than once by providing exceptional planning and extraordinary service each and every day. Go to ellenbecker.com and listen to Money Sense Saturdays at 2 and Sundays at noon.
Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Jamie Williams, wealth advisor for the Ellenbecker Investment Group. Ellenbecker Investment Group is located in Pewaukee, just north of I-94, between Highway 164 and Highway F. We're located in Ridgeview Corporate Park, and also in the village of Whitefish Bay and the Equitable Bank Building across from Winkies. We also service clients in Bonita Springs, Florida. Visit ellenbecker.com for more details. Today, our special guest is Dr. Glenn Miller. Dr. Miller is joining us from a host of really great educational background I'd like to share. He's a professor at Franklin L. Burns School of Real Estate and Construction Management in Denver, and internationally known for his work in market cycles in the public and private markets, and also academic director for Family Office Real Estate Institute, also known as FORE, F-O-R-E. So, Glenn, thank you so much for joining us today on Money Sense. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Excellent. So we got together about a year ago, and it's gone by so quickly, by the way, and hopefully you're enjoying your summer, and I'm sure things are gearing up for the fall, getting back to school.
Right.
So I thought today we would start off with you maybe sharing an overview of some of your work going back in the past, and maybe kind of some focus on your studies and focus on what you're working on projects related right now.
Sure. So been in the real estate business for 48 years, originally from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Lots of family in Milwaukee. My great-grandfather was Gettleman Beer. Have been researching real estate market cycles since the early 90s to help investors look at, obviously, the ups and downs. And for me, real estate really has two parts to the cycle, the physical cycle, which is demand and supply. And the combination of demand and supply in economics creates a occupancy level in properties. And if occupancy is going up, rents are going up. If occupancies are going down, rents are going down. So the income side of real estate really comes from that and is very local in nature. What's happening in Milwaukee is very different from what's happening in Chicago in any of the major property types. And then the second part of a real estate cycle would be the financial cycle, or capital flowing in. If money's flowing in, prices go up. If money's flowing out, prices go down. Same thing with the stock and bond market. So as I do that, I help institutional investors and REITs and other companies decide what property types and what markets they should be investing in. And it is useful in when people are doing large portfolios of properties, they want to diversify and be in different markets and potentially in different property types. So that's where my focus is on the income property side. Many people say, well, why don't you do that for housing? And I go, because housing is a use asset. Right. You buy it, you live in it, you use it just like your car. It isn't producing income for you. It's a use asset. So I take home ownership from income producing and separate them.
So that would be one of the the major asset classes, or I would say one of the five, right, which would be the apartment
office.
occupancy,
Yeah.
office,
Right.
Industrial, retail, and hotel.
Right. Exactly.
That's the main focus. And, you know, I was kind of looking back at the last year, and specifically with your market cycle report, which, by the way, is a wonderful report, extremely comprehensive and very insightful, where your report tends to kind of identify the trend and seek to capture a forecast of these five major property types. Just curious, you know, right before our last show a year ago, the Federal Reserve had stopped kind of the rate hike cycle, if you will, where they had raised rates 11 times, essentially, taking Fed funds rates to 5.5% from zero, essentially. Have you seen any significant changes in the past 12 months in your market cycle report?
So, again, the Federal Reserve's goal is to supposedly help control inflation. And they do that by, you know, setting the Fed's fund rate and have held it where it is for a year, waiting for inflation to come back down. And inflation has slowed now, as you well know. Mm-hmm. Is it to their target? Not quite. Many economists now think that, you know, the target of 2% is actually a little bit unrealistically low. Many of the people that I cover say they really should be thinking more like 3, which is mm-hmm. really where it's at now. And while it has definitely slowed the economy down, and which eventually will slow inflation down, we still are uniquely at a very high employment level with very little unemployment. People still having a hard time finding people to work for their companies.
Mm-hmm.
So that has really pushed wages up, and kind of, I think, slowed the, you know, the reduction in inflation rates. And by the way, when you break down what is made up in the consumer price index, I believe it's 30 to 35% of that is housing,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's both rental apartments or single family home ownership. And as you know, prices on housing have held very strong. And post COVID, apartment rents have pushed up as well. So when you have 40% of an index being driven by something where there's a lot of demand. And by the way, the National Association of Realtors say their estimate is that we are 6.5 million housing units short in this country.
Wow. Wow.
Which is incredible, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a lot of that comes from the fact that during the Great Recession of 08, 09, a lot of production builders, they were caught with a lot of inventory that they couldn't sell. And when I was a custom home builder myself back in the 70s and 80s, we had a saying, carry kills. If I finished a house and I didn't sell it within 9 months, all my profit was gone because it was eaten up in my construction loan interest. So most major national home builders and other any builder said, okay, I'm not going to build so many spec homes anymore to sell. I'm going to build a few. When one sells, I'll start another one. And we cut our production in half from 2 million a year to 1 million a year. Okay. Mm-hmm. And 2 million a year was about the right rate, the right level of production. So do that for, you know, the last decade, hence why we're short, you know, 6.5 million housing units in this country.
Right.
So, so that part of the inflation equation, I think, stays high for a while. Many people say, well, shouldn't I just wait till interest rates come down before I buy a house? And I go, absolutely not. If you do that, what happens? The prices go right back up, because when interest rates go down, I can afford a larger mortgage, therefore I can afford a higher price. Better off to pay the price now with a higher interest rate, and you can refinance your home at a lower interest rate 6 months, a year, 2 years down the road. Home ownership is going to be, I think, strong. We've got an easy 10-year run there. So the demand side is great.
Yep.
The supply side has been low in single family homes. It's been a little bit high in luxury downtown apartments, but completely missing in affordable housing from both a homeownership and a apartment standpoint. Hence, one of the reasons that I have joined a charity called Sharing Connection, where we help to finance and promote the development of affordable housing. The nice thing is, once an affordable place is built, the government will easily finance it. But getting that development loan at a higher interest rate makes it impossible.
That sounds wonderful. I'm certainly interested to hear more about that. As we kind of go through our show today, we're meeting with Dr. Glenn Miller, professor of construction and real estate management from the University of Denver. And I also want to, you know, just kind of circle back on a comment that we started to talk about the Fed and interest rates and inflation, which has had such a profound effect on the economy and housing in general, but also I imagine other areas of these five different major classes of real estate that we're talking about. At the beginning of this year, I remember, the market had priced in several rate cuts, you know, just in anticipation of possibly lowering rates. And then that narrative changed quite a bit as we entered further into this year. We're standing at a point now where the Fed has essentially said they're probably going to lower rates soon. When we come back from our break, I kind of want to talk about what type of effect that might have on at least, you know, the behavioral side of real estate, but also how it might translate into helping real estate investors and or homeowners with making a confident decision in their move. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Money Sense. Welcome back to Money Sense. This is Jamie Williams, Wealth Advisor with Ellen Becker Investment Group. Today we're meeting with Dr. Glenn Miller, Professor of Real Estate with the University of Denver. Before the break, we were talking about interest rates and, you know, kind of the inflationary stance that that we've been in terms of how that's affected the demand side. Glenn, do you have any thoughts on when the Fed starts to lower interest rates, what that might do in terms of providing some level of confidence to people? And or specifically what I look at is on the commercial lending side of things, because we have so many of these people that they're not on 30-year fixed mortgages. They're on 3-year, 5-year balloons. Maybe they're on ARMs. I know that we've had some people that had our ARMs reset and were very surprised at what happened when they got that first payment after the restructure of their loan.
Again, interest rates, historically go up and down. We're expecting them to start to come down a little bit here going forward. With a single family home, you can refinance anytime. And I say that because the law allows you to pay off a loan without any problem. In commercial income producing real estate, the maximum loan you're ever going to see is about 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that's happened in the commercial side is a lot of 6-8, 10 year loans that have been financed in the, you know, really low 2-3%, 4% interest rate environment are now resetting, and commercial is typically 1-2% higher than residential. And so all of a sudden it's like, oh, my payment's going to double, and the right income coming in off the property doesn't make that possible. So I guess I'm going to have to hand the property back to the bank. So right. That has created a difficult situation in the, you know, in the commercial marketplace. For homeowners, unless they somehow were able to finance a very, very large portion, 80, 90, 95% of their home, and all of a sudden their mortgage goes up and they can't afford it, hence they're ready to walk away from whatever equity they put down. That's one thing. Right now, it's actually less expensive to rent an apartment than it is to own a home in most cities around the country. So I assume that may happen a little bit, but also remember that prices have gone up. When interest rates started to go up, you would expect home prices to go down. Right. But with the low amount of supply that we have in the marketplace, that hasn't happened. In addition, all those people that did refinance and locked in a 10 to a 30 year fixed rate mortgage at, let's call it 3%, they can't sell that, go buy another house and afford the mortgage at 6. Mm-hmm. So that's why we have such low housing inventory, you know, available in the resale market as well, unless someone's being relocated by their company or something like that. Most people have stayed where they are from that standpoint. So,
yeah, I think I was watching some of the financial reports this morning, just in the morning news, with some of the large home, you know, retailers that provide a lot of, you know, product services, things of that nature, the Lowe's, the Home Depot's of the world and so forth. And it's very interesting, you know, based on their outlook, because there is a bit of a gridlock out there in the housing market, just based on people not, you know, wanting to leave their current home at the low rate they have. There's a little bit of disincentive for lenders, you know, out there too. They're certainly trying to borrow, but they have some road bumps and speed blocks, if you will. But nonetheless, I would say that back to your earlier point, the fact that someone who might be considering to purchase a home right now probably shouldn't hesitate, because it's not likely that home values are going to go down. I mean, we might see that. It's very unlikely. But when I also kind of think about what we saw in 2008, there was kind of a lagging effect when it came to valuations. And now we kind of have a front running effect with valuations on at least residential real estate. So when it comes to rising interest rates in the current rate environment and cap rates on commercial properties, whether it's owner occupied or investor, what type of effect does that have on commercial valuations?
Well, and now we really have to go kind of property type by property type. So, what happened was, when interest rates started to go up, property values basically went pretty much flat in apartments. In other words, the appreciation that we had had all of a sudden kind of went to zero. And if you looked long-term at a combined index of all the commercial property types, prices go up, then they flatten out, then they go back up, flatten out. Except during the Great Recession, when they actually came down. Post-COVID, they also came down. But there is Moody's, the big bond rating company. They have the CPPI, the Commercial Property Price Index.
Sure.
And that property price index peaked out just about, you know, kind of into the COVID period, if you will, around 2020. It declined about 17% over the next couple of years. And just in the past quarter, it has ticked back up by 1%. And I think that's because of the expectation of interest rates coming down. So now we may have seen that kind of bottom and then things picking back up. So from that standpoint, I think that fundamentally, things are going well. And again, let's go by property type. So great demand for apartments, other than Class A downtown being a little bit overbuilt.
Right.
You know, supply is moderate. So kind of number one property type there. Number two, industrial has been doing extremely well for the last decade. I call it the Amazon effect.
Sure.
And that got just a little bit overbuilt kind of starting in just pre-COVID, but the demand is still there and growing. So that looks good. Next, the real surprise is retail. Retail was, you know, hurt by the Amazon effect, if you will, and things closing. Well, over the last decade, that has slowed new supply in retail substantially. Mm-hmm. We have converted retail into other property types over the past you know, over the past decade. And so with low supply, you know, there's still been positive demand. And we've obviously changed what happens in retail over time. But retail has actually got the highest occupancy I've ever seen in 40 years. And last year, 80% of all new retail built was pre-leased.
Amazing.
So the demand supply balance there is great. Hotels, with the economy going all the way into 2019, things look great. COVID obviously just slammed the door shut. Coming back, we've had a year or two of what we call revenge travel. Hey, I had to go on a trip. I couldn't because of COVID. So now I got twice as much money to go on my vacations. And things, the resort has done extremely well. The highway hotels have done well. Downtown business hotels, because people are doing, you know, Zoom meetings instead, is still hurting in many cities. And some really high cost cities like San Francisco are still really hurting from that. So, but a hotel has bounced back in, you know, three of its four subsectors, if you will, and done well. And then finally, office obviously is the big problem. Big demand drop. A lot of properties being given back. We've seen anywhere from a 60 to an 80% decline in office prices.
Sure.
Except in the premium class A, like you're in very nice space there, and that's doing well. The best A-plus buildings in major cities are doing just fine. Other things are hurting. They're talking about converting it to apartments, all kinds of other things. So office has been, you know, and I think we got a couple of years to figure that out. To me, office is a jump ball.
That's a tough one because you need to convert it to apartments or housing. You need to have certain characteristics that I understand doesn't always exist in that type of structure. So very fascinating. Well, we're going to take another quick break. And again, we're meeting with Dr. Glenn Miller, professor of construction management and real estate at the University of Denver. Amongst others, I know you also teach at Harvard and have had a host of different programs that you've been involved in. So we'll love to hear more about that after this brief break. Thank you. Welcome back to Money Sense. This is Jamie Williams, wealth advisor with Ellen Becker Investment Group. And today we're resuming our conversation with Dr. Glenn Miller, professor of real estate and construction management at the University of Denver. Before the break, we were talking a lot about, the effects of COVID and, you know, interest rates and different market cycles that pertain to the five very significant areas that real estate, you know, has a presence in. And I wanted to kind of circle back on that conversation because we talked about the banking side and what interest rates might do from a standpoint of valuations and how with certain real estate investors, cash flow is key, right? Cash is king. It's the first thing they teach you in commercial lending school, which I used to be a commercial lender years ago. But I just thought I'd weigh in, Dr. Miller, on the underwriting guidelines that may have shifted, and if you've seen any differences between now and before the great financial crisis of 08.
Oh, sure. So basically, it came down to kind of the standard in the industry used to be a 75% loan to value on income producing real estate. And I use the term income producing instead of commercial because that then also brings in apartments. So the five major property types we talked about in the last segment.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And afterwards, the federal government came in and said, okay, we got to have better underwriting standards here. And they cut that from 75% to 60. And in doing so, that meant more cash had to go into buying the property. Hence, the amount of money spent on the mortgage dropped some. And so a building could actually have its cash flow decline some and still be able to pay the mortgage. So covering the mortgage became the key to that. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So banks were taking less risk, but it required more equity coming in when you're doing a property. But with really low interest rates, you know, that actually worked. That worked just fine. Because you had more cash flow to pay to the investors. You know, when it used to be a 5% mortgage versus a 4% mortgage, you know, that's a 20%, you know, decline in the amount of income being paid, you know, in the mortgage and going to the investors. So, you know, that tightening has kept us from going through a crash like we've done in the past. And people that in previous cycles might have said, oh, I'm going to walk away from the property, let the bank foreclose, let them sell it at the discount. They're going, hey, it's cash flowing enough to pay the mortgage. So I'll just wait it up because I know eventually prices will move back up.
Sure.
So that has helped stabilize the income producing commercial real estate marketplace over time. And we haven't seen as great a drop in prices in the price index. You know, if someone's forced to sell, they're forced to sell. But most places have kind of held, you know, saying, hey, I'm going to hold and wait kind of thing. So the market's less volatile than it used to be from that standpoint.
Sure, of course. And I think fundamentals on the underwriting side have strengthened and remain stronger across most of the major financial lending institutions out there. I know that at one point in time, it was hard for banks to try to get, you know, a handle on exactly how some of these real estate developers that were, maybe they were doing, you know, apartment condo conversions in major metropolitan areas, and they were partnering up with multiple different partners and they had a 10% stake. And, you know, I think they've kind of really pulled out their fine tooth comb on understanding the players, the liquidity, and like I said, you know, the fundamentals of debt service and cash flow for these organizations. So if anything, that should hopefully help as interest rates start to decline and bank underwriting continues to hopefully be strong out there,
right,
creating good credit quality for
correct
individuals and borrowers alike or investors. So I did want to kind of talk a little bit about, you know, some of the other real estate that's come on the scene that is newer. And in terms of the last, say, decade or so, we've got a lot of people investing in Airbnb, VRBO, some of those things. Have you seen that fundamentally shift any direct real estate investment for people?
So buying a house or a condo to use as an Airbnb, VRBO has become fairly popular. If you're in a place that's very attractive, you know, obviously you can make some good money doing that. The problem has been that the properties end up getting rented sometimes by some young yahoos who have big parties and a lot of people, and the neighbors start complaining. So the amount of regulation that has come into play has just exploded. My winter home is in the mountains of Colorado, and one of my neighbors renting his $3 million home had a bunch of young people show up and partying till late at night, you know, naked people out in the hot tub.
Oh boy.
And the neighborhood started complaining. So the HOA got together and said, hey, we're going to restrict this.
Sure.
Right.
Yep.
And the town, hearing from other neighborhoods, same kind of thing. So now you have to register with the town, get a license to do Airbnb. It's like $400, $500 a year to have a license. After two complaints, your license gets pulled. So you got to be very careful with who you rent to. You
sure.
Also, the hotel industry said, hey, this isn't fair. You're taking people that used to rent my hotel room, giving a place to stay. So now most towns will collect the hotel tax too. So the renter is not getting away with not paying, you know, the hotel night tax and that kind of stuff. So towns have gotten a lot of extra money coming in from that. So it's become very popular. I think it can work very well, but you got to be careful with, am I buying in a neighborhood where it's allowed? If there's no HOA, you're typically okay. Am I buying in a town where it's
right,
where I, you know, is it being regulated or not, is you know, part of what you have to be concerned about these days.
Yeah, that's something that I imagine not a lot of people put much thought into when it comes to, you know, tightening, you know, local municipal regulations, additional tax, you know, not to mention you're running a business and
correct
structure and tax side of things as well. So
right. Well,
very
and,
interesting.
And what you have is Real estate is, it's a, every building is its own little business. You've got clients, tenants, you've got expenses, you got to have somebody, either you're managing it or they're managing it. And if you're not there locally, you got to find a company who's going to run that for you, basically a property management company, and it's going to do the cleaning, on the turnover and all. It is, you're basically renting a hotel room.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot going on with it. And by the way, many of the major brands, Marriott, Hilton, et cetera, have started companies saying, hey, we'll manage your property for you.
So they're innovating. Interesting.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
That is fascinating. So, well, we're coming up on our next break here in a minute, but before we jump in, I know this, I don't want to put you on the spot here, Dr. Miller, but I know we're heading into an election year here, and we've got, a few months or probably less than 3 months before the election. Do you have any thoughts on how that might affect the real estate market? I mean, is there anything policy driven that might have an effect on the way things go, or it just probably not an issue?
Well, I think one of the things that happens is, the government, everybody is interested in affordable housing and doing something there. It is, I think one of the biggest problems in our country. And with all the spending that has been going on here in the past 4 years and our debts higher, et cetera, you can expect taxes to continue to go up, I think, no matter who wins. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of cases, and I don't know if you've seen this in the Milwaukee area, but in a lot of places, property taxes have gone up substantially and in some cases even doubled.
Yeah.
My home in Colorado, that happened. And it's not supposed to be that way. A town or a county or whatever has a budget, and you have a bunch of people, and you have the valuation of all the properties, right? And
mm-hmm.
so you just do that. So if the property values go up and the budget doesn't change, my price per thousand goes down and pays it. But what they've said is, hey, your property doubled in value, and so your taxes are doubling. That means the town's budget just doubled.
Oh,
what
man.
Are they, and they just are spending that money like crazy.
You
Post-COVID,
bet, yeah.
What did the government do? They went out and just gave away a ton of free money to put in playgrounds at parks and stuff like that. I drive around here in Minnesota, and parks that had nothing before now have these gorgeous multi-$10,000 playgrounds in them and stuff like that. So government spending is a problem.
Yeah. And yeah, that's something I want to explore further in our last segment here as we come up. But with that, we're going to take a brief break. We've been meeting with Dr. Glenn Miller, professor of real estate and construction management at the University of Denver. Welcome back to Money Sense. This is Jamie Williams. We've been meeting with Dr. Glenn Miller, who is a professor at the Burns School of Real Estate and Construction Management. Hope I got that right this time. Thank you.
Yep.
And we've been having a very intriguing conversation about real estate, kind of where things have been over the past couple decades, where things may be headed. But I did want to also kind of pick up here where we left off. And you were talking about the national debt, a little bit on the elections. And it is fascinating to think that we are currently at a $35 trillion and counting level since the late 70s and 80s, where we crossed the $1 trillion mark in the national debt. Again, and when it comes to, real estate investing and some of the things that are important, I believe that is that, that's something that was a policy item that you had referenced that could have a profound impact on real estate markets in the future.
Right. Yeah. So all that extra debt should actually, demand for money is there, should kind of keep interest rates high. But, it's funny, the government should want lower interest rates because then the cost of paying the interest on the debt for them goes down substantially. It's
Absolutely.
Basically the amount of budget to pay interest has basically doubled, during the last 3 to 4 years with these interest rates increasing. And
Absolutely.
yet the government hasn't slowed down that spending at all. That's the big problem. If you can drop interest rates lowers the government budget and therefore the amount of taxes they need to collect on us.
Yeah, when you think about it fundamentally, it just it absolutely makes sense. So
right.
Thank you. So with the rest of our time, I think it would make sense for us to kind of talk a little bit about real estate investing. You know, there's a number of different ways to have either a direct or passive way to invest. I know that you've written a lot about this. In fact, you wrote a book called Educated REIT Investing. You want to share a little bit about your book, and then
sure.
Maybe we could transition into some ideas for people on how to invest?
Sure. Great. So, yes, the REIT concept, was put into play in 1960. So it's been around for over 60 years. And the easy way to describe a REIT is it's just like a mutual fund. You take a bunch of investors, pool their money together under professional management with a particular focus. And in mutual funds, it might be growth, value, small cap, large cap, or mm-hmm. whatever. With REITs, it's a property type, and it might even be a sub property type. Like I can do a mall retail REIT, or a retail REIT that focuses only on grocery anchored shopping centers. So that's so REITs are a great way for investors who don't want to run their own business of owning a direct property, managing it, financing it, doing all. The companies do that, and they are the biggest and the best and the most sophisticated real estate investors on the planet Earth. Mm-hmm. My book, Educated Real Estate Investing, which is actually the first textbook to ever come out. There's a number of other textbooks out there on how to invest in real estate. I did mine with a good friend that really is kind of a good, easy step-by-step to understand the three main things that you look at. So when I look at a REIT, I look at what real estate do they own and what markets do they own it in. So that's step one. Step two is financial analysis. How much debt do they have, and how is that work? You know, and at what interest rates do they have it, and when does that come due? If I've got a REIT that's got a lot of a lot coming due this year, that means they're going to be financing at much higher rates. Or did they finance just before, you know, COVID came along, and they've got 9, 8, 7 years left of low interest rates? Okay, mm-hmm. REITs also have something unique that individual investors don't get. If I buy a building, I can get a loan on that building. In commercial real estate, I have covenants. I can't pay that loan off early. So if interest rates go down and I just finance my building at 6%, I can't refinance it at 5% without paying a penalty to do so. Okay.
Sure.
REITs, and I may have a rule that says I can't pay it off for the first 7 years. So I'm stuck with it. Mm-hmm. REITs, because they're publicly traded companies, they go out and issue corporate debt. So they'll issue a corporate bond and they'll place the properties as collateral for those bonds, but they have the right of substitution. So if I want to sell one property to buy another, I can say, okay, I'm taking this out of the collateral pool, selling it, buying another one to put back in, no charge, no difference, no change. So they've got that extra flexibility out there. And, the third thing is the management. What is management doing? Because it's an operating business. What is management doing to increase earnings per share? Are they developing new properties? Are they better at rehabbing properties? Are they better at leasing up than an individual would be? So it goes through those three major categories and steps to look at them. The other thing that's very unique about REITs is just like any other company, you're going to look at the earnings multiple. We, you know, in the stock market, we call it the PE multiple, yep. Price to earnings multiple. With REITs, we use what we call FFO or cash flow, because REITs have a lot of depreciation and GAAP accounting requires that they take out depreciation. So when I look at Microsoft and its earnings, it has almost nothing in depreciation. Right. When I look at REITs, and look at that REIT, its earnings, right, its NOI is going to look really low because it has a lot of depreciation. So we add the depreciation back to get to a cash flow we call funds from operation.
Okay.
That makes it more comparable. Okay. But the other hugely unique thing about REITs are they own a lot of properties. And if their stock price is low, they could sell a property at a high price and buy back their own shares. Okay. And we call it net asset value. So every real estate analyst out there, every sophisticated REIT investor, all the companies managing funds on this, they do we call it net asset value analysis. And they say, okay, if tomorrow we know what properties are worth in the private market using a cap rate, yep. If we sold all the properties and paid off all the loans and took whatever cash is left over and gave it to the investors, in the marketplace today, the stock is selling at $20 a share. But if we liquidate the company tomorrow, we could literally distribute $25. That okay. means that the company is trading below NAV or net asset value. I want to buy that company, right? It gives me right. downside protection. Over time, just like any operating company, if you look at Microsoft, what's it's worth some multiple of its earnings, right?
Right.
Historically, REITs have traded it at around 10 to 13% above net asset value because you're expecting them to increase earnings. So when they're trading below, I want in. When they're trading way above, if they're trading at 20% above NAV, that's my signal to get out.
So great. That is very insightful. I know I wish we had more time today because there's so many areas that we could go into on that. We didn't talk about private equity. We didn't, also didn't really talk about non-publicly traded REITs, but those are also areas that maybe in our next show, we can kind of dive into a little bit more. But in our last couple of minutes today, I thought it would be great to, just find out more about your Sharing Connections nonprofit organization that you're on the board for, and then also find out about how to connect with your materials, certainly understand more about the Market Cycle Monitor. So if you wouldn't mind just sharing
sure.
that, we would right. really appreciate it.
So my Market Cycle Monitor is available at the university at du.edu under the Byrne School. And it's also available on on Sharing Connection, which by the way is spelled with an X to make it different. So it's sharingconnection.org. And what Sharing Connection does is, again, developers have to go get a loan to build something, and we help fund that. As a matter of fact, we have a if you will, a fund that helps do that. And as opposed to asking for your donation, what mm-hmm. we ask for is we want you to make a loan to our fund that has a high impact because it's going to help with affordable housing, but at a low interest rate. So in other words, many, many people are being philanthropic and they don't necessarily want to give it away,
sure.
but they're okay with, we're basically offering the 10-year treasury rate. So you're going to get a 4 or 4.5% interest rate. And it's on a development deal where you can say, hey, you're doing you're going to help finance some affordable housing in Milwaukee. I want in on that deal. And then the next one you say, hey, we're doing one in New York. Say, no, I'm not interested in that one. So what we're looking for is people saying, hey, I'd be willing to, invest in something that comes up. And when it does, it'll say this is a 1 year, a 2 year, typically the max would be 3 year deal. I'm willing to help by lending some money at this low rate, to help get some good affordable housing done. So it's a unique approach to to what's going on. I personally have done one investment with it, and we work on all kinds of things. We had some modular home builders who were doing some affordable housing project, and they got a really big order, and they went, we need $1 million
wow.
just to get the materials to build these, and the bank says we're already near our credit limit. So we made a loan to do that. It lasted for 6 months.
Wow, that is fascinating.
So kind of a new, unique, innovative way to help out with affordable housing.
We'll definitely have to take a look at that. And we also appreciate you sharing your insight. And we're kind of at the end of our time today. I definitely look forward to our next conversation. It's been very insightful talking with you today, Dr. Miller. We've been meeting with Dr. Glenn Miller, professor at the Byrne School of Real Estate and Construction Management. And if you like today's show, we certainly want you to learn more about EIG and our upcoming events, you can visit us at ellenbecker.com or call our office at 262-691-3200. Money Sense airs on Saturdays from 2 to 3 p.m. and on Sundays from 12 to 1. As always, we definitely hope that we've made a difference in your personal and financial well-being with this show, as well as all of our other Money Sense shows. And certainly remember, before we plan, before we advise, before we invest our clients' assets, we always listen. Thank you. Have a great day.